Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Florian Shad here, your host for this weekend show. In this weekend show, we're going to be focusing on resources, commodity investing, starting off with a big focus on the energy sector because, well, this war in Iran continues to dominate the headlines, and it's also dominating what's going on, especially in the oil price and some of the oil stocks. A lot of oil stocks continuing to melt higher, and I think the biggest confusion that I have is actually what's going on in this war. We keep getting, it seems like, conflicting stories, but what I'm watching is if this war seems to be slowing down, and right now it doesn't seem to be. So who knows when it's going to end, but we do need to, I think, have a game plan for if this war continues and if it stops in the near term, what the trickle through could be and how quickly energy markets could correct. That all being said, we are chatting with Joseph Schachter. Joseph is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report, also writes the Ion Energy Report. That is on Substack. The Ion Energy Report focuses more on the macro energy prices. Schachter Energy Report dives into the stocks. Joseph, look, we're kicking off the show with you because I want to get a little bit more clarification or at least your thoughts on what the trickle through of this war in Iran will have on energy prices. Look, oil, as we're recording this, about halfway through the day on Tuesday, is in the 90s. It's been volatile, but quite frankly, it's holding at higher levels. I know some people are out there trying to short it, thinking this war is going to end, but that's been kind of a losing trade. However, oil is off of some of its highs from when it spiked up to 120. Joseph, just make sense of this Strait of Hormuz issue. This seems to be the biggest issue here, where so much oil and even natural gas is shipped through this strait and its impact really globally on the price of oil. So give us kind of your data on the Strait of Hormuz, why it's so important to the energy price, and what the longer term impact could be of essentially a shutdown.
Yeah, let's put the numbers in context. Global demand is about 106 million, 106.1, 106.2, depending upon, you know, whose estimates you're using. And 20 million barrels comes out of the Persian Gulf. So it's a good percentage. And it's a big percentage, mostly for Asia and mostly for Europe. So the United States, as we all know, is self-sufficient, 23.7 million barrels produced, 21 consumed. So they're a net exporter. We export, we're a net exporter to the United States and more and more through TMX to Asia. So the Straits of Hormuz is important for both oil, for natural gas. Qatar, there's been attacks against the fields there, and they've had to shut in natural gas production. As you shut in natural gas production, you also shut in sulfur, and the 25% of the global sulfur that's used in fertilizer also is not moving. So you've got a problem with the cost side on planting by farmers. And this is the time of year that you start doing it. So that means that, a potential doubling in the cost of fertilizer. So can farmers afford it? And if they can't, then the yields will go down. And that means food prices will go up. So let's talk first about President Trump says that the Straits of Hormuz are open. Yeah, it's open to China and Indian, buyers of Iranian crude and any of ones that Iran says will let through. But if it's anyone that is not, they don't let you through. They are still attacking with drones, commercial, crude carriers and ships carrying, the big, structural components and fertilizer and, cargoes. And so we've got a problem here where until the last, we don't see for a couple of days in a row where there's no drone attacks, no attacks on facilities, ballistic missile attacks in UAE or Oman or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. The owners of the 800 ships that are blocked in this area they're not going to go through because the owners are going to say, no, I can't afford to, you know, lose my ship. I can't afford to lose my personnel. So until you see no attacks or so few that people will start saying, okay, I can take the risk, I don't think you can say the war is over. And if this thing is the same 2 weeks from now, that's not going to be good. And if it's a month from now, it'll be very not good. You know, if it's 2 weeks from now, $96 today becomes 110 to 120, back to the highs that we saw just 2 weeks ago. And then I think the big problem becomes if this is mid-April, late April, and we're still doing the same kind of attacks and the same volume of attacks, same problems, we could be pushing above 120. The all-time high 147, which we made in the summer of 2008, if this thing continues into June, July, we're going to even blow past that because by then inventories will go down. Let's put inventories in context. We have 90 days of inventories right now. That's going to go down, of course, in the next issue, and it'll be going lower every month from now on because the Russian crude is being used, Venezuelan crude that was in their shadow fleets is being used. So the lowest level we ever had was in 2008, and we were down to 79 days. And so we're 90. So if we get to 80, 84, then that's going to be a warning. If we get below 80, that's going to be really problematic. And on the other hand, if you go back to COVID, when the economy shut down, we went up to 120 days of inventories. And then 6 months later, we were back in the low 90s. So to me, I'm watching days of inventory. And, the crude stocks are doing very well because the days of inventory really look like they're coming down and the price is very strong. You can't hedge out far because of the nearby futures are high because of the, expectation the war is going to end early. If the war does not end quickly, then the price curve will continue to rise. Right now, if you wanted to do November of 2026, you might only get in the mid-60s versus you might get, mid-90s on the next contract for WTI. So I think we need to see, the war end for things to get back to normal. The energy stocks that are oily have done exceedingly well, and we got all 52-week highs in many of them. Right now, my comment to our subscribers is, if you have an investment position that you bought and was 4 or 5, and now it's 10, 12, 14%, it's only prudent to pull some of that back, build cash reserves on those names. And if people are saying, well, what's still worth buying, I would say natural gas stocks. Natural gas stocks have not lifted at all or even only a small amount. And so I believe that natural gas will do better, later this year and into the outgoing years as more LNG plants come on, as more, the problem with Qatar is going to set up the European and Asian gas prices will be high. And so, if you have an ability to move your gas, we're going to see higher prices. So LNG Canada is finally getting to, the 2 BCF a day. That should strengthen prices from the summer through the fall. And then, of course, winter of 26, 27, we could be looking at $3 to $4 AECO, and you're probably looking at $4 to $5 for NYMEX.
All right. So a lot to dive into there, Joseph. Could be a contrarian play on the nat gas stocks right now, especially if things start catching up there. There's some big spreads between what we see in North America and what we see in Europe or Asia. So a big delta there to capture. As far as oil prices, if they get to triple digits, of course, that's going to be a net positive for energy companies. My question is, before we dive into all the companies, Joseph, what would triple digit oil prices do to the economy, to inflation, to consumers at the gas pump, to businesses that rely on freight? What does that do to inflation, CPI? So just from a effects, what would that mean to the economy? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, Shad, what we're seeing now from more and more, if you watch Bloomberg, business, or you watch CNBC, even, Bloomberg Canada, BNN, they're talking about the longer this lasts, the higher the probability of global recession. And so if that happens, maybe that 106.1 number I'm using for global demand this year may not be the case. Last year, it was 105.1. So I'm losing a million barrels more. If it's a global recession, maybe there's no demand growth. That would then push the price of oil down after the war is over, even more so than people might have thought. okay, we're 96 today, the war is over, you know, sometime in April, do we go down into the 70s and then, you know, move around in the 70, 80 range for a while? If you know from our prior discussions, I was using for 2026 $70 average, and our view was in Q2 that OPEC production would show that they can't increase production. That would wake prices up into the 70s. And in Q4, as we saw global inventories shrink, we would get into the 80s. All of those forecasts are out to lunch now. They're not going to be there. Right now, I would probably say we're looking at an 80 number for the year on average. And the question is, where are we going to be in Q3, Q4? And again, how far is the war and how big are inventory? So, you know, if somebody asked me to give a fearless forecast for 2026, I can't, because I don't know what global inventories are going to be at the end of the war. Once I see that number, then and number of days of inventory, then you can start coming up with a prediction.
So, Joseph, one thing we keep hearing, or I hear about the U.S., is that they're energy independent. So they can supply all their citizens with the oil that they need, but still, the price of oil could move higher, and that impacts Americans. Any changes on the supply to not dynamic just coming out of the U.S. to either take advantage of these higher prices or somehow, I guess, put a Band-Aid on this war and its impact on other countries?
Well, the United States doesn't have a problem for themselves, but it's a global commodity, so it trades on a global basis. So, you know, if you look at last week, we'll get another report on next Wednesday or tomorrow. They were 13.7 for domestic production, and that's up 103,000 from 2025, on the same week. And then you had 9.99 million barrels of natural gas liquids and renewables, and that's up 570 from a year ago. So the U.S. not only is self-sufficient, it's, you know, the Permian with all the liquids-rich gas, condensate and propane and all the other things that are coming out of it. They're self-sufficient, and the consumption last week was 21.2 million barrels. So you're looking at, as I said, you know, 2.4 million barrel surplus. They exported last week 3.4 million barrels, you know, they imported 6.4, and of that, 4 million comes from Canada, you know, because they need our heavy oil in their refineries, and the light oil coming out of the Permian is what's getting exported. So but the problem is it's a global commodity. You know, tankers can move it around everywhere. So the U.S. is paying at the pump the higher price for fuel, for gasoline right now and diesel because of that. The natural gas price is a domestic price. You know, if you have a locked in, you know, continental situation and you have not an extra ability to move it to Europe or Asia, which is effectively the lock in for Canada and partially for the States, because they're producing 20 BCF a day and they're moving it, but they could probably move 30 or 40. And right now they're building facilities to get to 30 BCF by the end of the decade. So, you know, if you have stranded gas, it's trading cheaply as AECO and NYMEX are. And we'll have to wait. 310, 312, I think, is NYMEX today. And I mentioned earlier, $1.85 for AECO. So these prices are landlocked prices. But on the other side of it, oil 96. And remember, the Canadian oil trades, you know, because most of it, a lot of it is heavy. So there's a discount. But then multiply that by the Canadian dollar, 1.37. And that's why the oil stocks are running, because the amount of cash flow they're going to get in Q1 is going to be much higher than Q4 and much higher than Q1 of 2025.
Joseph, there's been a lot to do about the strategic petroleum reserves being released kind of as a Band-Aid, but what is your thoughts on how long they can play that game? Because I thought they were still working on filling them up at one point, and now they're releasing it all. When does that effect run out? Does it have that much of an effect? And at what point does it become a situation where inflation gets so big, this starts interrupting central bank policy?
Well, I think central banks, you know, always seems to use the PCE and the X food and X energy. Well, you can't X food and X energy. That's the affordability issue where the Democrats are beating up the Republicans right now. And affordability is still going to be an issue. So I think that, you know, food and energy are going to be rising. The Fed is going to be boxed in. Stagflation is the word that people will start using because the economy will be slow or slowing and going negative, and inflation will be rising. So it's going to be what we saw in the late 70s. And then, of course, we needed Paul Volcker to come in and with other central bankers to beat up the inflation. So, you know, to me, you know, the inflation worry is real. And, you know, right now, affordability is there. Mortgage rates have gone up in the United States. The 10-year yield has gone up 20 beeps almost in the last few weeks. We hear more and more about private credit being a problem in the United States. Spreads on junk bonds versus quality bonds are widening. You know, this to me in some ways looks like 2008. You know, it was the leveraged bond situations and the housing issue. And but, you know, we also have derivatives that could be a problem. And we don't hear much about that anymore. But everybody talks about the size of the derivative market. And if somebody doesn't trust somebody like they didn't trust Lehman or Bear Stearns, all of a sudden, you know, game over. So I think that there's a lot of reasons to be cautious here. It doesn't mean not to be invested. But if you, as I mentioned, if you have oil stocks that have doubled or tripled and they're way out of position relative to your norm of weightings, you know, it's only prudent on portfolio management wise to do it. And if you want to reinvest, then my comment is if you want to reinvest in energy, then look at the natural gas name.
Joseph, so we will get to the natural gas names, but in terms of the oil names, should we expect any of these companies to increase production to try to take advantage of these higher prices here and now?
So far, on all the conference calls that I've been on, we have not heard anybody saying that. What they're saying is if they, you know, remember, a lot of these companies put in hedges at lower oil prices. So the amount that's hedged is not getting the benefit. You know, they might have $60 to $70 collars when we're 96 US, and that might be, let's say, 115, 120 Canadian. So they left a lot on the table on the percentage that's hedged. And all you can do is hedge out a month or two at these high prices or sell it at the spot market, which is what a lot of them are doing. The cash that's coming in, I think companies are going to use it to continue to improve their balance sheets. Many of them still have debt issues. Others are, you know, are good financial shape. If they think their stock is cheap, they're doing NCIBs. Many of them are paying dividends, and they just, you know, make the dividend, you know, cover that much stronger. You know, and for conservative investors, you know, you can still find yields in the 6-7% range in the market even today.
Well, Joseph, I'm glad you got into the hedging because we've had a couple of people send in questions about this. You've already mentioned the forward curve is still not anywhere close to where pricing is today. It's a lot lower. But as that starts creeping up, what percentage of companies do have things hedged as far as the research you've done, and to what amount? Because most companies, it's only a partial hedge. Any information there you can share?
The lowest that you know, like there's some that are totally unhedged and there's others that are 20-30%. I think some can go up to 50 with their board approval. And if they want to go above it, then they have to again go to the board to get an increase. So 30 to 50 seems to be about the number, both for oil and for gas. And if you can add additional hedges, again, you just get a quick board meeting and say, look, you know, we're sitting at 96. We can hedge into May or April. You know, let's do another 5,000 barrels. And if the board votes yes, then that can happen. But nobody's going to go 100%. You know, if you go 60, 70, that's as far as prudence would allow you to do it.
Joseph, how do we find out how these companies are hedging? If they are hedging, what their hedges might be? Is it simply just the kind of earnings reports, or is there something else we can look at to figure this out?
Some of them have it on their websites and others just report it in their quarterly reports. We're still going through the, let's say, the two-thirds of the way through the Q4 2025 report cycle. And so between now and, let's say, the end of the month or early the next month, we're still going to be having companies reporting. So that's where you can get all the information on your company, see what they've done for hedging. One thing I recommend, and you and I've talked, we've talked about this before, is if you own a company and they do quarterly presentations, webcasts, go and listen to the webcast, because not only do you want to hear what the company says, but you want to listen to what the analysts are asking about the portfolio managers on the buy side, asking management, because what's on their mind will probably be what's on your mind. And you can have hear somebody ask that question and get an answer from management. So that's really a great value, FaceTime with management and hearing what they have to say.
Joseph, do you think right now that the companies that are the most unhedged, actually the ways to play it because they can benefit from the crazy price swings to the upside, are there any companies that stand out as being less hedged or unhedged that maybe have more torque right now?
You know, there are some that are, let's go through those that are oily. You know, Freehold Royalty, I don't think they do much hedging. Paramount, 53%. Again, not so much there. I'm just going through my numbers. Whitecap, 61%. They do have hedging, but remember, they have a lot of debt from the Veren acquisition. Bonterra, 51%, not so much. Gran Tierra, 82%, not so much. And that's why their stock's at a 52-week high. Obsidian Energy, another one, 72%. Valeura Energy, 100% is liquids. 88% for Surge. They do some hedging, but quite a bit unhedged. So there's lots of opportunity. If I went to Hemisphere, 99%, and I don't know how, I don't think there's much hedging there. In Place, 60%, Rubellite, 72%. So, you know, these companies do have some hedges, but there's still a lot of upside from the unhedged portion.
All right, Joseph, time to move over to the natural gas stocks then. You keep on saying that you think that is the opportunity, especially the Canadian ones. Which ones stand out to you? Which ones, even on the other side, do you think you should avoid? Or is this simply a shotgun approach? But buy any natural gas stocks and ride them higher.
Well, you know, I think you got to go to the ones that have the ability to grow, that will benefit from the LNG export market. So some of them have moved. Some of them have not moved a lot. We're a big fan of Birchcliff. We've been for quite a while. You know, you go to a Tourmaline, 77%, you know, natural gas. So upside there. Vermilion is 69% natural gas, but they're already benefiting it from the high European prices. So the stock's run and it's now at a 52-week high, you know, 1686. It was a $7 stock, you know, at the low in April of last year. So big move there. If you go to, you know, domestic here, Cavvy Energy, 80% natural gas. Pinecliff, 81% natural gas. Pinecliff was the only one that we had as a topic now in our last SER, because we think at, you know, these levels under, you know, 70 cents and lower, the stock is a bargain. Then you go to, you know, names, you know, like Petra, 65%, and then you go to 58% for Yangara. So there are names you can go after that are cheap. And, you know, I think the key thing is nibble away on those. And, you know, if you have overweighted oily names, take profits.
Joseph, we get a lot of questions about U.S. versus Canada for nat gas stocks or for oil stocks. So any thoughts there? Is there a preference of U.S. versus Canada for nat gas, U.S. versus Canada for oil stocks?
On the oil stocks, both sides have had a good run. So they've all done well. And if you compare, you know, the Canadian to U.S. names oily, I think you'd see similar kind of performance. Middle-sized oily Canadian names may outperform even the U.S. mid-size oily names. The natural gas side, the Americans are getting a higher price. They're getting, you know, 310, 315. I haven't seen the latest. So, you know, we're only getting $1.80 in Canada. So the Canadian names have lagged what's going on in the States. And so people who've owned natural gas names in the States have done better. But if you look from here into a year down the road and the next 3 to 5 years, I think the Canadian natural gas names will outperform the U.S. names, because we're going to go from, you know, 2 BCF to 6, 7 BCF. The Americans are going to of LNG. The Americans are going to go from 20 BCF to 30. So the Canadian growth rate will be much higher. And that's really the torque to make the Canadian's price of natural gas run more from here than the U.S. NYMEX price.
All right, Joseph, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you very much for sharing your insights on, I guess, where the opportunities lie while this war in Iran continues, and trying to give us some, I guess, straightforward insights on the Strait of Hormuz. As I said, it's all very kind of opaque, if you ask me, in terms of the information we're getting, but it does seem like this war is very much continuing, and the Strait still seems relatively shut in. So we'll see if anything changes. But here and now, that's all we have for everybody. And that's all you have for us. So Joseph, thank you very much for joining us on this weekend show. And again, you want to follow along with Joseph, check out the Schachter Energy Report or Ion Energy on Substack. I will post a link to both of those reports in the show notes. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back, switching our focus a little more to the metals sector and some of the moves in the metals prices.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.